What to do about Donald Trump. Hi, welcome to Friday and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with the Mossback, Knute Berger of Crosscut. Good to see you, Knute.
Good to see you, Bill.
Sean Scott, Seattle filmmaker and columnist at City Arts Magazine. Hi, Sean.
How you doing?
Good, good. Glad to have you here. Bill Finkbeiner, former Republican State Senate Majority Leader. Welcome back.
Hey, Bill.
And, of course, we're live tweeting all this hour at KUOW. This week, some leading Republicans said Donald Trump must be stopped.
He's playing the members of the American public for suckers. He gets a free ride to the White House, and all we get is a lousy hat. And let me put it very plainly. If we Republicans choose Donald Trump as our nominee, the prospects for a safe and prosperous future are greatly diminished.
That's Mitt Romney saying the thing to do is vote for other Republicans. Some Democrats say Rubio could beat Hillary Clinton, but Trump can't, so the thing to do is hope Trump wins the nomination. Or Trump is Mussolini, and the thing to do is what? Take to the streets in mass protest? Sean, what's the thing to do about Donald Trump?
I think he needs to stay in the race and go as far as his the political winds seem like they're ready to take him. I think that the GOP electorate has spoken pretty eloquently and clearly about what they want. I don't particularly like what they're saying, but I think that it's basically it's starting to become increasingly clear that, you know, this message of Trump's is very appealing to people, right? The combination of sort of a faux economic populism going around in states that have been really hard hit by deindustrialization, people experiencing economic anxiety that stretches back 35 years, that coupled with sort of the, you know, really the white nationalist appeals that he's not, afraid of courting. It's a really intoxicating and clearly powerful message that's starting to resonate and that has resonated for a lot of people. So I think it's a situation where, unfortunately, a lot of the political capital that we're going to see him start to spend in a lot of ways is earned.
So that's a calm Sean Scott saying basically this is what democracy looks like. Bill Finkbeiner, you're a Republican. You told us you're losing sleep over Donald Trump.
You know, I was in politics for a long time, and, so people would obviously talked about it a lot. And I just remember so many times talking to people who were upset about Bush, or they were upset about Obama, or they're upset about Clinton, or about Congress, or about this or that. And I always say, look, it's not worth it. You know, most of these people that are getting elected and that are running, they're really trying to do what's right for the nation. We've got a strong nation, and, you know, there's going to be mistakes along the way, but it's going to be okay. And getting upset doesn't help. And then I find myself getting very upset about what's happening this year.
So what is your version of the thing to do about
Donald Trump?
My
concern is that Trump is sort of emboldening a group of people and validating some feelings that some people and really playing on and sort of accentuating some of the worst in America. And I just really think it's dangerous. And
so what should Republicans do?
So I think there's sort of there's a couple of tacks, you know, that you've seen. So you've seen Rubio really go back and sort of sink right down to Trump's level and give it back as good as he gets. You know, there's an old saying in politics that never get in the mud and fight with a pig because the pig loves it and you end up muddy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some of that happening to Rubio. And I think, yesterday what Mitt Romney did, I think that can be effective. I think people just have to start speaking up, and I think they have to make a couple of points. And I think one of the points is that, Trump is – it really is. It's a con. He's clearly, just hitting people's buttons and trying to – do whatever he can to build his support without obviously having any strongly held beliefs about any of it.
Okay, so Bill Finkbeiner, I'm not hearing Mussolini. I'm hearing speak up. I bring up Mussolini because Knute Berger, you are studying fascism right now, so I want to know what to do about Trump. But I want to know, is Trump a fascist?
I don't think you can call him a fascist, but he acts like one at times and certainly has said things that appeal to that mindset. Jennifer Rubin, the very conservative columnist for the Washington Post, called him a proto-fascist in her column today, which I thought was pretty amazing considering, where Republican politics, how it's split and divided. I mean, You know, liberals.
Do you agree with that? Proto-fascist?
Yeah, I think that's probably pretty fair, right. a pretty fair description, especially based on his comments last night about disregarding international law and order, you know, and his willingness to order the military and the way he talked about the military. They're going to do what I say. I mean, he pulls out this strongman act. And I think it's more than an act. I mean,
he would be commander in chief.
He would be commander in chief. But, you know, the Nuremberg trials were full of people who followed orders. And, the decisions about what is torture and killing the families, innocent families of people and that kind of thing. I mean, it gets into a very, very dark area. And I really don't think you can play that down. On the other hand, I mean, liberals, Democrats, you know, have been looking at the GOP race as kind of refer to the candidates as, you know, the occupants of a clown car. We've been, you know, watching these kind of nutty people come as the parties move further and further to the right. And you see these candidates espousing all kinds of weird ideas. And now the clown car has crashed. You know, it's like becoming a flaming wreck, and we're finding out that one of the clowns is not a happy clown. You know, he's John Wayne Gacy, I think. You know, I mean, it's a scary clown.
Well, let me ask Republican Bill Finkbeiner: is your party a flaming crashed clown car? I mean, is the party dissolving?
I think it very well could. At the very least, it's gonna change dramatically. I think no matter what happens, because either Trump gets the gets the delegates that he needs to win at the convention, in which case I think, you know, the Republican Party loses this, you know, it changes dramatically, or he doesn't get it. And now you have a brokered convention, and I think that's also going to dramatically change the party. So I think it's really, and I think before Democrats, you know, probably a lot of your listeners are going, well, hey, what's so bad about that, right? That could be a good thing. But I think that, you know, when you see that kind of chaos in politics, it can a lot of times get worse before it gets better. And I think it's a serious thing. With that said, I really think that, you know, the country, and I think people, you know, we got a strong institutions and strong traditions, and, you know, it's going to be okay. It's not, you know, it's not the end of the world, but it's pretty serious.
We've been talking about Trump's would-be policies. I wonder if you think we should separate Trump's manners, because there's been a lot of complaining about rudeness. This is Trump responding to Mitt Romney, who Trump endorsed in 2012.
You can see how loyal he is. He was begging for my endorsement. I could have said, Mitt, drop to your knees. He would have dropped to his knees. He was begging.
Sean, do you care about Trump being coarse or vulgar or rude?
What I care about personally is the fact that that sort of way of conducting himself in public resonates very widely, and that it's really kind of the cultural corollary to the appeal and very strong appeal that he seems to have to voters who, as I said at the top, have really been dealing with, you know, deindustrialization and a lot of economic anxiety. I think if you're a member of the Republican Party or you're somebody who supports the GOP, the question that you have to ask yourself is how was it that it took a candidate who is this fringe and this inflammatory to really address certain issues that I feel like we collectively as a country should be talking about anyway. So the coarseness, I think, really kind of feeds back into really the central demographic of his campaign, which is people who have gotten to a situation or gotten into a point where they're ready to blame women, blame immigrants, blame ethnic minorities, blame whoever it takes, but, you know, actual structures of power for problems that they might be experiencing, particularly around pocketbook issues.
Final question then. Knut, where is Washington State in all of this? Is Washington State really any different from any other state when it comes to Trump?
Well, of course, in presidential elections, Washington has been a pretty reliable Democratic state.
I should say Washington Republicans.
Oh, Washington right. Republicans. Yeah. Well, as far as Republicans, I've heard that there are very few Republicans coming out for Trump. I think they're either more traditionally conservative or trying to gain back the sort of Dan Evans moderate branch. Certainly Chris Vance, who's running against Patty Murray for Senate, and Bill Bryant, who's running for governor against Jay Inslee. They're not Trump embracers.
But they haven't said that, at least I'm,
yeah,
I don't think
no,
either one
I,
of them has said that they will not vote for the Republican nominee, whoever it is.
And that is a big dilemma for all the Republicans, including the presidential candidates who last night swore that they would support the support the nominee.
Which kind of neuters the argument.
Democrats like to nationalize elections in Washington state. And Donald Trump is Jay Inslee's best friend for reelection. If Donald Trump gets the nomination, it will mobilize Democrats. And I think that will help in Washington. And it will hurt moderate Republicans here, which is why I think they're afraid of him.
Okay, then the last point, Bill Finkbeiner, are Washington state Republicans any different from Republicans nationwide?
So first of all, Trump's not getting a majority of voters. For the most part, he's getting a plurality. So he's getting about 35% in most of these primaries and caucuses. And, you know, I hate to say it, but he just did that in Massachusetts.
Will he win in Washington?
I mean, unless something changes. And I think the candidates who are running this year as Republicans should disavow him and do a quick.
Okay. Been talking about what to do about Donald Trump. You know, at the big conservative political action conference going on, CPAC in D.C., activists there booed at the mention of Mitt Romney's speech. And the head of the Republican National Committee said, Republicans who want to undermine Trump can do what they want to, but, quote, I would suggest that it's better to win. So Republicans cannot agree on what victory looks like. Coming up on the Week in Review, what about Democrats? Can they agree on what victory looks like? We're going to take that up in about 7 minutes. And if you missed the Trump discussion, get our podcast, KOW Week in Review, on your favorite podcast app. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke.
911, what are you reporting?
This week, a Seattle Seahawks player went to a health club and got 911 called on him. And here's what we know. The Redmond Athletic Club has closed. It's on the market for sale. Seahawks player Cam Chancellor says he was interested in buying it. So on Wednesday afternoon, he and four other people went to the club, which, although closed, had some employees inside. Chancellor says he asked for help. He looked in the glass. But a store worker told 911 the group was doing more than looking.
They're trying to get in, and we have told them multiple times they need to leave. There's five of them, and they're trying to, like, pound on our doors and break in, and I'm not really sure it's going to be next.
They just kind of, like, pound on our doors and break in, and I'm not really sure what's going to be next. The Redmond police came, and by all accounts, everyone was nice about it. But that night, Cam Chancellor tweeted, "The funniest thing just happened to me in Redmond. I went to go get info on a gym that was closed, and two ladies called the cops on me." So the question is, what should that employee have done? And then what should you do if you're afraid and don't know whether that's rational or not? Sean, what was your take on what happened to Cam Chancellor?
I thought it was an incredible story. The symbolism of it is something that was really out of a novel in some ways. I mean, it's, you know, the story about an employee who's concerned about property. There's a woman who's afraid of personal boundaries. And then there's also, you know, a big black male at the center of the story that, you know, in a lot of ways, society has sort of coded us to fear and really informed our gaze and the way that we look at people who, you know, embody Cam Chancellor's stature. So in some ways, it's kind of a perfect crime story, except the problem is that there's not actually a crime at the center of it. I'm just kind of really amazed that somebody did not recognize Cam Chancellor. And my big question and my big takeaway is whether or not the 49ers put her up to it somehow. Taken away, I think.
Here's a little more of what that employee told the 911 dispatcher.
I mean, there's five of them. There's like three African-American, two whites. I couldn't see any weapons, but they got cameras and pictures, and I'm really not sure what they're trying to do here.
How long have they been there?
Like 10 minutes.
Okay. And do you know why they're trying to get in? Do you think they're trying to burglarize
it?
Or
can you just get somebody over here, please? I mean, I don't know what's coming next. They're bad news, so.
They're bad news. This has made national news. This woman has been called a racist, even though there's a lot we don't know. Canute, what do you think she should have done in her position?
Well, I can't say. I mean, obviously, if she felt personally threatened for any reason, I can understand why she would call the police. The issue is why did she feel threatened? Was it because a black man was knocking on the door? It just underscores that. you know, if people talk about, you know, white privilege, I mean, the story to me just underscores that if I can think of examples in my own life of going up to a house, knocking somebody, you know, expecting someone to be there. Nobody's there, going around the back, looking in the window. I never got the cops called on me, you know, that kind of thing. You know, you have the feeling if Cam Chancellor showed up in uniform, it wouldn't have been an issue. But because he was a black man who didn't appear to be a football player, which is an acceptable role, you know, she feels a level of fear that, you know, that's my assumption. But on the, you know, on the other hand, she did what she thought she had to do. And I'm really glad the cops handled it well.
Yeah, well, some things she could have done, you know, she may have thought, what do I owe to this person who, you know, I don't know what they're up to. And she admitted that. She wasn't freaked out. She was saying, I don't know what they're up to. She did drop some references about, you know, well, you heard her say they're bad news. How does she know they're bad news? But she could think, well, that person, no matter who they are, they're going to get, if I call the cops, they're going to get hassled. If there's an altercation with police, they might get blamed. It could even get violent. So minimum, doesn't she need to think about, okay, let's think about everybody here in this situation where we don't know all the facts. Here is one more bit I want to play from the conversation.
Still in the parking lot?
Yeah, they were trying to get us to open the door, ask for information. I don't know if they're like homeless kids. I know that there used to be a lot of heroin addicts around here.
Do they look like teenagers?
They looked older than teenagers. I would say they're probably early 20s, maybe mid-20s. They were trying to take a bunch of pictures, and I don't even know what they're doing right now. Showing in the parking lot in their big black, is that a Chevy?
So have any of you had, you mentioned, Knut, you've gone around the back and didn't get hassled. I knocked. Was it knocking or banging, right? But I knocked with fervor on the door of a jewelry store that had closed, a jewelry store which has valuable stuff in it. And they let me in, and I bought a ring for the woman I've been married to for 10 years. Happy ending, right? Nobody called the cops on me. Have any of you ever, Sean, have you ever been the afraid one or the feared one?
Fortunately not. I am somebody who was raised with a very strong paternal influence and was always, you know, people talk about respectability politics and the thing that things that African-Americans often have to do. And
which I should say you are African-American.
Right. And the level of self-awareness that we have to have in everyday situations. I think I agree with Knut that there's a certain layer of privilege that unfortunately both African-Americans and women, in the case of the store employee, we don't have that luxury. So I think I fortunately have never found myself in that situation only because of, I think, just luck and being super hyper aware in ways that I don't feel like I should have to be, frankly.
But I don't hear you outraged at this store employee who didn't know what was going to happen next.
It's, you know, it's kind of a light story in some ways because, you know, anybody who follows sport and anybody who knows how much the Seahawks have meant over the years to the community, it's kind of a story that's easy to laugh off in a lot of ways. But, you know, the unfortunate reality of it is there's actually a story last or a couple of years ago where a player for the Atlanta Hawks had his leg broken by the New York Police Department. Thabo Sefolosha, if I'm not mistaken, is his name. And, you know, it's happening at sort of the same time as a lot of these other instances that are highlighting police overreaches of power. So I guess after a couple years of dealing with that, I'm just a little bit happy to have, you know, kind of a story that did not end with somebody getting their leg broken or gunned down in the street in some ways. So there's a certain level of levity that I think we're able to have with this particular conversation that's not there the majority of the time.
We've been talking about Seahawks player Cam Chancellor, who had 911 called on this week. By the way, the conclusion to the story about the club is that Cam Chancellor said, basically, I won't be buying a health club in Redmond. We've been asking you how this should have gone down and what you would do. And I'm curious if you, listeners, have had any experience with this. You can give us a call at 221-3663. Tweet us at KUOW. We'd like to hear your thoughts and your story. Coming up on the Week in Review, should Seattle bail out a bike share program? And is that something a true cycling city does? That's coming up. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. Knute Berger with Crosscut is here. Bill Finkbeiner, former Republican state senator. Seattle filmmaker Sean Scott, columnist at City Arts Magazine. After this week's Super Tuesday voting, Hillary Clinton is well in the delegate lead. Clinton supporters say even if you like Sanders, it's time to unite behind Hillary. Sean, you have supported Bernie Sanders. Is it now time to unify behind Clinton?
It's time to do anything but that at this stage of the race. I think, you know, I want to take, sort of listeners back on a time back to May of 2008, right? Hillary Clinton is coming off of, a streak where she's lost 12 out of 15 or so states. The campaign is growing increasingly desperate after sort of mounting what was thought to be an insurmountable lead in delegates and superdelegates. And Hillary Clinton is coming out having to donate $1.5 million of her own money to her campaign. At one point in time, she says that she's staying in the race because there's a chance Barack Obama might get assassinated like RFK did in 1968. And the race kind of falls apart for her when it seemed early in the year at about the same time that, it seemed like she had it in hand. So I think that as a student of history, I look back on that period, and I was very much following that race, very much engaged. I think it's important to realize and remember that, it's nothing has been decided yet.
Bill Finkbeiner, you think this race is over, has been for a while.
Yep.
It's Clinton's, so therefore, should Democrats support Clinton now?
Actually, what I think is that Clinton will be stronger the longer that Sanders stays in the race. I actually think it makes her a stronger candidate.
Why?
For a couple of reasons. One is that she's in a position now where she's basically got the delegates that she needs, or she's on a path where she's going to get them. So she can be really magnanimous and basically reach out and take a lot of the energy that Sanders has generated and a lot of the excitement. I mean, I think clearly Sanders is where the excitement and the fire is at, and in the Democratic primaries, and she can use that, frankly, and especially if she starts, I wouldn't be surprised to see her start adopting some of his platforms, or at least ideas in general. I think when she's talking about college affordability, I could see that happening, and really, once he's gone, then the discussion is going to change, and it's really going to be all on the Republican side. As long as Sanders in the race, it's still she's part of the story.
But help me understand this, Knute. Hillary Clinton might be magnanimous, but Bernie Sanders keeps telling Democratic voters not to vote for Clinton, even if the alternative might be Trump. How does his ongoing criticism of her not weaken her support?
Well, Every candidate is making their best case for themselves. And I think, Bernie Sanders is doing that. And it's clearly resonated with a big chunk of the party and people who are not in the party, which is kind of another issue. I think it strengthens her because hopefully it'll make her a better campaigner. I think it strengthens the party to have everybody listen to the people who support Bernie Sanders, just like the people who support Hillary Clinton have a right to go to the convention. They have a right to be heard. They have a right to be on primetime. And the time for unity is once a nominee is selected. Mm-hmm. The real question is, will Bernie Sanders supporters come to vote for Hillary, and will Hillary supporters vote for Bernie Sanders, depending on who actually ends up with the nomination?
And you think it's not over yet?
Well, I don't think it's over. I think, I agree there are things that can happen along the way. I think the whole email thing with Hillary is wildly overblown, but you never know. I mean, if there were some kind of indictment or something that happened, she could be derailed. There could be other, health reasons or other things could come up for either candidate. So, the process is you battle it out in caucuses and primaries, and then you come together at the convention. And I think that, I think that's fine. One question I have is that there are a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters who are not Democrats, and there are some who are socialists like Shama Sawant. They are supporting Bernie Sanders, even though he's running as a Democrat, but they do not want him to get the Democratic nomination and run as a Democrat. In other words, their strategy is support him as much as possible, organize locally. But if Bernie Sanders loses the nomination, they hope he'll run as a third party candidate. That's one of the concerns I think Democrats have is can they get all in one tent at the end?
Right. So it's all about the unity at the end of this process. So Sean, who's more electable, Sanders or Clinton?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of polls are really clear on the question that or clear on the statement that Clinton surprisingly has a lot of problems against against Trump. And I think the fact it really comes down to the fact that Sanders and Trump, I think, are both really talking about material frustrations that are quite real. The solution that one of those candidates has posited is one of isolationism and prejudice. The solution, to my eye and ear, that the other of those candidates has provided is one of progress and certain ideals that are much more affiliated with the kind of country that I want to see.
You're a Bernie Sanders supporter, but Sanders more electable? Is that what you're saying?
I think so.
Okay. Bill Finkbein, a Republican, who do you fear more? Clinton, Sanders.
You know, honestly, at this point in time, I'm getting my head around being ready to vote for either one of them. So,
Who's more electable?
You know, I don't know. I think it's a moot point because I really do think that Clinton's got it wrapped up. I think at this point in time, even an email server's story isn't gonna derail her. And okay. I think I think not to get back to the Trump thing again, but his probably best shot would be as if Sanders ran as a third party. So that would surprise me if he did that.
Knute, you're a Democrat. If you're thinking who could get elected president, Clinton or Sanders?
Yeah, I lean Hillary, but would be happy to vote for either.
Okay. Stay in Bernie. Stay in Bernie and stay in Bernie on our particular unscientific panel. Then the question is, who is more electable? This is KUOW's Week in Review, and we'll come right back and talk about who should be coerced into getting help. Stay tuned. The Week in Review, right here on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. This week, Washington state lawmakers have been considering a law to allow involuntary commitment for drug addicts. The bill's been put forward by Lauren Davis. She works on King County's Substance Abuse and Mental Health Advisory Boards and on suicide prevention. And she says this is a matter of life and death.
Ricky's law only applies for somebody who meets a very, very high standard. So they're at imminent risk of serious harm to themselves, to someone else, or they're gravely disabled, meaning they're so sick they can't care for their very basic needs of food, water, and shelter because of that addiction. So this is it's not just somebody who's drinking or smoking pot. It's people who are extremely ill, and it is categorically wrong to let people die in our state every year.
Categorically wrong to let an addict die, Knute, when we could get them into treatment. Do you agree?
Well, I certainly agree with the goal of saving lives. When I hear involuntary anything, I get kind of nervous and suspicious. I've read a little bit about the law. I've talked to some people about it. The mental health and addiction and these things are very complicated. I really sympathize with the idea that there needs to be more beds for people who are in these kinds of crisis situations, so I get that. But also there are other ways of saving lives in the addiction. KUOW had a story, I think, this week about what was going on in Vancouver with these injection centers and whatnot, where addicts can come in and take their drugs, and it's reduced death from overdoses and that kind of thing dramatically. So there's more than one way to save a life. I also know that in many cases, drug addiction is a symptom of a problem, and sometimes, and I've heard this from therapists, that sometimes the underlying psychological cause of the addiction, the trauma there, certain kinds of trauma, can be triggered if people are involuntarily committed. In other words, it can actually push them closer to suicide or something because of the sort of shame and trauma of being forced to do something. That may be isolated cases. I don't know. I'm not an expert on it. It just seems like it's a complex issue and maybe just one piece of a much bigger safety net that we need to create.
Bill Finkbeiner, is there a scenario in which a family should be allowed to involuntarily commit an addict, as we can do currently if it's a matter of psychiatric treatment, but not if it's a matter of substance abuse.
My understanding is you can commit them if they're at imminent, you know, risk of harming themselves or others. So that's there
you
now.
You can put it in the category of psychiatric treatment. It can be guaranteed involuntary commitment. Right now, the state doesn't have to provide beds for somebody who's
exactly.
addicted to a substance.
And that seems sort of there's two parts to this. So one is, you know, should you be able to have that ability to involuntarily commit somebody? And then the other is, okay, if that is going to be the case, where are they going to go? And that I tend to side with Knut. I think that as soon as you start to talk about involuntarily, I get what the person was saying where they're like, look, this isn't because somebody's been drinking too much or because they've been smoking pot. This is only in the most extreme situations. But if they really are at imminent threat of dying themselves, it sounds to me like the current law would cover that. But the problem then is okay, so now where are they going to go? And that's where obviously we really need to start to boost things up and make sure there's places for people to go when they need and when they're looking for, or when their families have, you know, gone through this to bring them in.
So where does the money come from to, as you say, boost things up?
Yeah, well, that's always a challenge, obviously, but it's a matter of setting priorities. And it feels like, you know, obviously awareness on this issue and the devastation it causes. Everybody knows somebody or friend of a friend who's gone through something like this. And it's obvious, you know, I think as a society, we're ready to prioritize that. There's money there if it's a priority.
Sean, should we have any kind of forced treatment for addicts in Washington? And why or why not? What makes you come to that conclusion?
I think we ought to. And I think about, you know, the kind of the paradox that addiction is something that affects the individual, or that the individual has to battle with, but also has repercussions for the community. You were bringing up sort of the financial question and whether or not we would be able to pay for it. And, you know, one thing that I point to is the fact that a lot of patients who are at risk to self or others are people who appear first in, mental health courts or in front of first responders or jails, all of those emergency rooms. Those are all things that I think also take a toll and in the long run actually cost more money, more time, more energy, rather than sort of a more direct commitment to allowing the families of people who are suffering to get, a much more direct and I think concentrated form.
That bill's supporter makes exactly that point. She says it's a money saver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you think? Knut brought up the idea of injection centers as an alternative.
I'm a little bit queasy as well about any situation where it seems like care work is in some ways being offshored. I think that if an injection center is a possibility, then we can also go ahead and go, you know, the next step further and say that we need to make a full scale commitment to helping communities cope with addiction.
The bill we're discussing is known as Rickey's Law, and it's in the state legislature right now. What do you think, Bill? Odds? Do you have any sense of whether this will pass or not?
Going back to when I was in the legislature, there was a pretty strong sort of bipartisan group that would get concerned about, this type of sort of civil liberty issue. So it'd surprise me if that's changed too much.
This bill would allow involuntary commitment to chemical dependency treatment if somebody's at risk of serious harm to themselves, to others, or is gravely disabled by an addiction to drugs or alcohol. And we'll follow it through the legislature here on KUOW Seattle. You're listening to The Week in Review. Sean Scott is a Seattle filmmaker, also working on the book Millennials and the Moments That Made Us, a cultural history of the U.S. from 1984 to the present. We have Bill Finkbeiner here, former Republican State Senate Majority Leader, Crosscut's Mossback columnist, and writes for Seattle Weekly, Knut Berger. And I'm Bill Radke. We're reviewing the week gone by. You know those lime green bikes around Seattle? Those are the Prado rideshare bikes. People are not riding them nearly as much as hoped for by the nonprofit that runs Pronto. This week, a city council committee said Seattle should buy the program and expand it. And this gets to the heart of an identity crisis. Are we a city of cyclists? Car drivers? Should biking be a private indulgence, a city priority? Bill Finkbeiner, what should we do with Pronto?
Yeah, I think, you know, we're going to have to start to get used to this, especially in Seattle. Whether you are an urbanist or a NIMBY, I think you pretty much have to recognize that getting around Seattle in your car is going to be increasingly a challenge. And
that's why people move to the suburbs.
Yeah, sometimes.
That's why we build transit, so they ride light rail.
That's right.
But they're not riding these bikes, so now what?
Well, they're going to have to – I mean, people are going to be riding bikes, I think, in Seattle in the future. It's just it's going to be one of the only alternatives to get around. And so I think – you know, the city spent a lot of money on infrastructure. This might just be something that takes a little bit longer to take off. So I think you got to hang with it and see this thing through, especially when you look at the cost of the infrastructure and the, you know, the lanes and that sort of thing to, you know, to allow a real bike infrastructure in the city. Then, you know, the cost of Pronto sort of pales in comparison to that. And that's how it's going to work is you get people on there, you get people on the bikes. So, you know, maybe it just takes a little while.
Bill Finkbeiner, Republican, says buy those bikes.
Yeah.
Knut, what should we do with Pronto?
I was just thinking, you know, back at the turn of the century when Seattle had 23 miles of dedicated bike trails and they had bike paths in downtown Seattle that commuters could use and bike toll road. I mean, you know, we were way ahead of the curve back in the 1890s, and it was Republicans. It was Republicans who promoted cycling back in that era. You know, I look at the Pronto thing. I don't know ultimately whether it will work or not. I don't think we're spending enough on bike infrastructure. I think we ought, you know, ought to spend more, and clearly there are plans to do that. And it seems to me a program like Pronto could be part of that. I'd have no problem with the city. It seems like an experiment, and we're early in the experiment. There were some disappointments in the first year in terms of ridership, but there was also some success. There's, I think, thoughts that if the program's expanded, it will have a better chance. And when you think about the amount of money, I mean, I do think this should be part of public transit. I do think that when you think about the amount of money, it's like barely even a rounding error on an overrun on 520 or Bertha. You know, it's just not that much money. And I think that we could spend a lot more on experiments as well as basic infrastructure to get back to, and I agree with Bill, people are going to be riding their bikes more. It's a good thing that they do. And I think it just ought to be integrated with our public transit.
But here's what City Council member Lisa Herbold says. She voted against buying it. She says we should make bike share privately owned, like Car2Go. That's a car sharing program, privately owned, successful. She says New York City has a privately owned bike share system. San Francisco does. Miami Beach does. And she says we asked city voters to approve almost a $1 billion levy last year because we can't maintain and expand the infrastructure that we have. We have an obligation, she says, to spend our transportation funds wisely, which she says is not Pronto. Your rebuttal, Bill Finkbeiner?
Well, I think that's all makes sense as long as there's going to be a private entity that does come along and provides, you know, a broad access to bikes. And, you know, if that happens, great, and it works and people use them, super. But if, you know, getting rid of Pronto means then there's nothing that replaces it, then you've got a lot of, you know, you got a lot of investment in bike infrastructure and not as many people using it. And I agree with Knut. It's like the point of making a $1 billion, billion-dollar investment in Move Seattle, and then you're saying $1 million to, you know, to get people out there on bikes. It's sort of it's pretty divergent scale.
By the way, Sean said you couldn't get super worked up about Pronto one way or the other, so I'm not going to force you to pretend you're super worked up about it.
I'll just say it's too small to fail.
Well, it's too small to fail? Knut, aren't you saying that cycling is too noble to fail? I mean, they did a program. It has got not many riders. 391 rides a day, says the Seattle Times. That's about seven rides at each station per day for a revenue of $30 a day. Is cycling just too noble to fail? I mean, when does it not work?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of nobility, but I think there are a lot more people cycling today than when certain infrastructure was built for cycling. For example, the tunnel through Mount Baker Ridge was built for bicyclists. And, you know, it's been slowly adopted. Now it's become a key part of a bike corridor. These things evolve over time, but they don't evolve unless you invest in them. And that's really clear with public infrastructure. And I would consider something like bike share or Pronto or some version of that to be basic infrastructure that you invest in. And then you alter course over time, you know, as people begin to use it. And I think the advocates of it make a good case that there are ways in which the system could be better designed. And I think it's better if the public is making those decisions than some private entity that's trying to make money off of it.
Yeah, Mike O'Brien on the council pointed out that a private company does the profitable routes, the tourist routes, but the city would plan it for everybody and make it work with transit. But maybe if it fails, somebody else comes along and does it better. We'll see. Bill Finkbeiter, by the way, I just want to say, you said you'd be happy to, you live in Bellevue, right?
Yeah.
You said, we'll buy them.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind them coming over there. We got the East Side Rail Corridor getting some great momentum this last couple of weeks. That's going to be really exciting. I think in a few years, you're going to be able to bike from Renton to Woodinville and a real option to I-405 on the east side.
All right. If you live in Bellevue, contact Bill Finkbeiner. If you live in Seattle, you still have a say in whether to bail out Pronto. The full city council meets March 14th and could cast its votes then. So you've got a little over a week to weigh in. Coming up, you wouldn't open your umbrella on a bicycle, right? Why would you open one when you're walking? Does a real Seattleite use an umbrella? We'll have a discussion in less than 10 minutes. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Travel writer Rick Steves, based in Edmonds, known worldwide, was a big supporter of legal marijuana in Washington State. This week, Steves said 2016 is the year for pot to become legal across the United States. So let's talk about that. Bill Finkbeiner, you're president. It comes across desk. Do you legalize pot nationwide or do you
Trump
not?
Trump didn't win.
Right. Trump did not win.
All right.
It was a late in the con- it was a
That's
broken
right. It was
convention.
A broken convention. Yeah, right.
To give it to hand it to Finkbeiner. Hugely controversial, but the fact is you're in office. Whatever you thought of the eggs that got broken to do it,
there
President Finkbeiner, do you legalize pot nationwide or don't you?
I think we're a little early for it. I think, you know, we've got the states that are going forward, and each time another state moves forward, we learn a lot. And I think we learn a lot about sort of the balance between having a functioning market, one that doesn't basically leave most of the sales still in the black market, and at the same time not having a market that's so functional that it's sort of like, you know, turns into the beer and alcohol situation where it's essentially sort of growing demand in order to feed itself. So,
okay, we learn a lot. So what have we learned in Washington State?
I think in Washington State we learned, one, that there's challenges with medical marijuana existing at the same time as legal marijuana. I think we've also learned that there's a certain point maybe where we put so many restrictions that it's difficult for these businesses to sort of operate and compete with the black market, which I think, you know, for this thing to work, they sort of have to. And then I think we've learned, you know, some from Colorado and some from Oregon, and that'll keep happening. And I think it's inevitable, but I don't think it's this year. I think, you know, maybe we're a few, 4, 5, 10 years away.
Okay, Bill Finkbeiner's first act as president is to veto the pot legalization measure. But maybe he's open to maybe in his second term. Knute Berger, President Berger, pot legal nationwide. After we've been experimenting, what do we do?
Yeah, well, it depends on what's in the bill. But if there's regulation, taxation, and legalization, yeah, I think it needs those elements as opposed to just being a blanket legalization. And that certainly would jibe with what Rick Steves is after. I mean, he was a critical person in getting it passed here in Washington and Oregon. There are about 14 states at least that are discussing legalized marijuana. There are a number that are putting it on the ballot in 2016. There are probably 4 states where it has a really good chance of passing: California, Nevada, Maine, and I'm forgetting what the other one was. But there I think the thought is that this is a year, presumably you'll have a good Democratic turnout. Higher voter turnout is seen to help. And if you get a critical mass of states legalizing it, at some point the feds will have to. Now, whether it's this year now, but the reason you're going to be hearing a lot about it this year is because it's a presidential election year and initiatives of this kind probably have a good chance.
Okay. President Scott, nobody thought you had the delegates to do it, but a masterfully run campaign. And what are you going to do about legal pot?
Not only is that one of the first things that I do in office, but the second thing I do in office is increase federal funding to universities that are researching time travel so I can go back in time and do it even sooner.
Wow. That's doubling down.
It really is. Yeah. It's long past time. I think as a millennial and a Reagan baby, I look back on a failed 30-year drug war. And the question we have to start asking is, why has this not happened yet? Is there a connection between a very powerful pharmaceutical lobby, between a very strong private prison lobby that has found ways to actually monetize really the disproportionate and unjust criminalization of, you know, people who buy, sell, and use a plant that grows in the ground? I think it's people are going to look back on this era and really, I think, be confounded that it didn't happen sooner. And so I'm glad to see these states really push the envelope.
But if legal marijuana means more people smoking marijuana, good or bad?
The science to me seems pretty clear that it's less of a public health risk than, you know, our dependence on petroleum and the fact that we all live lifestyles that are so dependent or so beholden to automobiles and cigarettes.
But would more people smoke pot if it were legal? Do you think that you even agree with that premise?
I haven't seen enough to make me think one way or another. I think it's already something, especially in this region, that's so culturally accepted that I don't know, at least for Washington State, whether or not that would have such a huge impact. But I think it needs to happen.
But I ask because there's theory and there's practice, and I wonder if those are just two separate things. Are you saying, yeah, more people might smoke pot? I don't like it, but liberty is liberty. Or do you even think that there's some kind of the country's going to be better in some way because of legal marijuana?
I think people should be able to use it.
Okay. All right. We've heard from President Scott, who is not having any of the opposition. And otherwise, give it time, say Knute Berger and Bill Finkbeiner. Rick Steves is saying this is the year to legalize pot nationwide. So for now, we'll keep experimenting in Washington State and other states. As Knute said, maybe it's the state-by-state experimentation that is how American legalization is going to happen. More of the Week in Review under the bumper chute in a moment. People are a little depressed about hearing the phrase Reagan baby come from Sean Scott. Even you, Sean, you said it and you didn't seem to be happy about it.
Yeah, man.
Heavy lies the crown.
Heavy lies the crown. Millennial Sean Scott there and Knute Berger and Bill Finkbeiner. I'm Bill Radke, and you have been living through the wettest winter in Seattle history by inches of rainfall from October through February. Now, many locals will tell you a real Seattleite does not carry an umbrella.
I don't want to carry something that's just going to get wet. I have a perfectly good hat and a perfectly good coat, so I don't need an umbrella unless it is downpouring. And even then, I just walk through it. I'll dry off. We all dry off.
Real Seattleites wear rain gear.
As an adopted Seattleite, I'd say you don't need an umbrella if you're a true Seattleite.
But it has been pouring this winter, and some Seattleites say it's time to give up that identity no umbrella thing and pick up the bumper chute.
I don't like a wet head. And it's been raining. Like, this winter, it's rained so hard and so long and so intense. Like, it's not just like the little misty, drippy stuff that you can walk around for a while in. It's just been intense a lot of times. That's my defense.
Seattleites need to do more than just wear rain jackets, and so I'm starting that trend with an umbrella like this, and hopefully people will follow me.
Will you follow Knute Berger, umbrella, yes or no? Mossback?
I use an umbrella maybe once a year at the most. And that's when it's
raining. That's the camel's nose under the tent.
Yeah, exactly. It's when it's raining really hard, it's warm, and I have to wear a suit somewhere.
Mm.
And maybe that's once every 3 years. So I do have an umbrella, but I never take it anywhere, so I still have it.
Okay. You get to still be called a mossback. Bill Finkbeiner, umbrella, yes or no?
Yeah, no umbrellas. I grew up here and then, you know, not too worried about my hairdo anymore. So,
yeah, you have umbrellas. Taken care of that issue.
That's right.
With the finely cropped hairdo that you have. So not an issue. So and Sean Scott, umbrella, yes or no?
I think for me personally, in general, no. But I also want to point out how funny it is. You know, unless you're a member of the Duwamish or Suquamish tribe, it's kind of hard to have a conversation about who's really, really, truly, really to down to the core Seattleite. So I think, you know, I think if you got a roof over your head, you should be okay with being able to carry around an umbrella.
Okay, here's the knock, though. Here's where other people's right to swing their fist ends at my nose. Umbrellas get in everybody's way, right? So
sometimes somebody else brings one and then you can share it.
Oh, that's such a more positive, humanistic way to look at it. Thank you for bringing the love there. Yesterday on this show, I have to say, I did say, get a hood, wear a waterproof coat. A listener named Ben wasn't buying that.
If you wear a Gore-Tex jacket and you don't wear Gore-Tex pants, the rain sheets off of your Gore-Tex jacket onto your non-Gore-Tex pants. And then you got a wet crotch. If you're going to do anything, it's no Gore-Tex at all or all Gore-Tex all the time, and umbrellas are stupid.
Right. You have to pick one or the other, and I'm saying I pick umbrellas are stupid. And aren't you embracing the elements? Isn't that what Seattle is supposed to be about? You're embracing nature. You're not dodging it.
Yeah, and certainly if you move here, you have no right to complain about the rain because it's not like we kept that a secret, right? It's like the one thing everybody knows here.
Right. All right, the Week in Review. So we all said, no, 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 but get a life. Let other people open their dang umbrella. All right. And what about you? 206-221-3663. Convince your fellow Seattleites one way or the other. 221-3663. Or join us on Twitter. We actually have a hashtag, Seattle Umbrella Debate, and it's being had. I've seen some fantastic pictures. Backpack umbrella, which does take up, you know, gets rid of my objection that you're occupying 50% of your free hands. And then there's this geodesic dome looking thing. It's like she's enclosed in her umbrella, and I have to respect that. So use that hashtag Seattle Umbrella Debate. This is KOW's Week in Review. Sean Scott, Bill Finkbeiner, Knute Berger. It's been a pleasure having you this week. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks.
Thank you for tuning in. We'll do it again next week.